This is Reverend Kingfish, anointed and appointed, sanctified and consecrated, performer of blues, stomps, and novelty tunes designed for the discriminating listener.
That's wonderful. Thank you. So are you like an ordained minister?
I am. I paid $30 online and I got my ordination from some church that I think is in a basement in San Jose, California.
Oh, wonderful.
So a lot of people would not consider me a real minister. But I'll tell you what, I've met enough ministers who've gone through the whole divinity thing, and they come out, and I don't agree with what they say. But I'm a student of the Bible in my own way, and I consider myself to be a religious person in a very personal sense.
So just starting off in Rochester, have you always lived here? Or?
Well, I lived in upstate New York all my life, and most of my life. My parents moved around quite a bit. But Binghamton, Utica, and Rochester were the places that I mostly grew up. I graduated from Penfield High School, and then I left to conquer the world, and the world conquered me. And here I am back about 45 years later to rediscover Rochester.
If you don't mind me asking, where are some of the places that you ended up?
Well, mostly New York City, California. That's mostly it.
So how did you get your start in music, go as far back as you can remember?
Well, my father was a great music fan. He had great taste in music. So I grew up listening to Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan and Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and above all, Ella Fitzgerald. He loved Ella Fitzgerald and listened to her a lot. So that was my growing up experience. Of course, I had older brothers and sisters, so I always listened to what they had, Beatles and some folk music and Bob Dylan, that kind of thing. But I really woke up in high school when two things happened. One was I listened to a record called Hot Tuna by the band Hot Tuna. It was their very first album, just Jorma Kaukonen and Jack Cassidy. And on that album, they were performing tunes by Reverend Gary Davis and Leroy Carr and Jelly Roll Morton, people who I never heard of and didn't know anything about their music at the time. And that was very inspiring. Something about that clicked. The other thing was a good friend of mine, Danny Gotham, lent me an album called Charlie Christian, The Genius of Charlie Christian. And when I heard Charlie Christian, it just like was a bolt out of the blue. I just couldn't believe what this guy was doing with the Benny Goodman Band back in the late 1930s. So those were two of my really strong early experiences.
When did you first, you know, pick up an instrument?
Well, I started when I was about 13, 14 years old. I had a hand-me-down guitar from my brother, and I got a chord book and just, you know, sat on the front porch and, you know, learned every chord I possibly could. Didn't know how to put them together to make a song, but I figured if I knew the chords, I'd figure it out at some point. And then I wanted to always develop a finger-picking style. And that goes back to the early folk days. But then when I listened to Hot Tuna, I learned a different way of playing finger picking, you know, a more syncopated way. And that interested me a lot. And then along the way, I was influenced by other people, certainly Leon Redbone. And more recently, I've been Junior Brown and Wayne Hancock. People like that. People are more like we call roots musicians. They've been the big influences on me musically.
Now, are there any other more contemporary musicians that you've listened to and said, I kind of like this?
Not really. There's really nobody that I can think of right now. Because I spend a lot of my time listening to the old stuff, you know, Bessie Smith, Jimmy Rogers, Fats Waller, the stuff from the 1920s and 30s. I find that to be an endless inspiration. I just spend a lot of my time listening to that, and I don't pay a whole lot of attention to what's current or recent.
I guess they don't make them like they used to.
Well, they don't, and, you know, everything moves on, and everything becomes different, and there's, you know, tons of so many different musical styles out there that everybody should have what they like. But more recently, I have been more interested in the early jump blues and rockabilly stuff. Particularly a guy named Charlie Feathers did some really great early stuff. And so I've been listening to that too.
So in terms of the local Rochester arts community, do you feel that there's like a place for your music?
Well, so far there is. Rochester has a great music scene, really quite remarkable, actually. The amount of music going on here locally and stuff coming through is quite amazing. You've got venues like Abilene, where Danny Deutsch brings in a steady stream of great talent. The Spirit Room is where I play right now every Wednesday, and that's a great place. They serve a very special role in the community as a safe place for marginalized people and marginalized musicians. They are a very open space. I've played at B-Side in Fairport, and I'm going to be playing at the Little Theater Cafe coming up, and there's tons more places around, and Rochester has an extremely vibrant music scene. I'm very happy to be here because of that.
What about those venues do you think is, like, special?
Well, it's always the personality of the people who are running the place. At Abilene, Danny is just an incredible supporter of all kinds of music, all kinds of artists. He brings people in from all over and gives them an opportunity to show their stuff. Down at the Spirit Room, it's just a very special environment that they've built down there. It's hard to describe if you haven't been there, but you just feel like you're almost in an old bar from, you know, the turn of the century, and you can just sit and chat with people or listen to music and relax. It's a great scene.
So speaking of the people in this community, do you collaborate with other musicians often?
Well, I play with, there's a few musicians that I play with regularly. Dave Chisholm plays trumpet, great guy. Rick McRae on trombone. Dan Lopata plays bass. Hannah Piquet, piano. And every time we play, it's a collaboration of sorts because I don't have anything worked out. And everybody just finds their part and does what they want to do. I've had a great experience with the burlesque dancer, Miss Ruby Sparkles, who allowed me to accompany her on a performance at the Spirit Room a couple of months back. And I certainly look forward to the opportunity of working with her again.
How do you work out the difference between, like, playing, you know, with other musicians versus, like, playing as part of, like, a show, like an entertainment act?
Well, I've never really been part of an entertainment act. Everything I do is very ad hoc, and I kind of like it that way. I like to just have people show up and know the tunes. I have charts for everything that we do, and they have to be decent musicians to be able to follow the stuff, you know, kind of sight unseen. But if they're good enough and the groove is right, everything just kind of melds together and works very well.
It's kind of a magic to it.
Oh, absolutely. And you need the chemistry. You need the chemistry of the players. But Rochester has a deep well of talent, I'll put it that way.
And so just about live performances in general, what do you enjoy about performing?
Well, mostly I enjoy playing with great musicians. Not that the audience is secondary. I always want to do things that please people, but I'm not primarily concerned with that. I'm primarily concerned with playing good music with good musicians and also performing songs that are meaningful to me. I play mostly original music, and the stuff that I write is very personal and sometimes a little bit on the edge. So you need the right kind of audience to appreciate that.
As you said, not that the audience comes secondary. What do you think, or what do you hope that people get out of listening to your music?
Well, most of my music has to do with the deep, dark side of human nature, the side that most people try to hide. We all wear masks, and I try to get behind that mask and tap into the kind of primal feelings that people carry around inside of them, sometimes the anger, the lust, all of the things that are considered bad but are part of human nature. And part of the reason I'm so interested in that is some of the big influences on me early on were like Robert Crumb, the great cartoonist, who just kind of was able to tap into the hypocrisy and hidden agenda that most people have. Another big influence was John Waters, his films like Polyester and Female Trouble. Ed Wood, the great filmmaker, Plan 9 from Outer Space. If you haven't seen anything by Russ Meyer, he had a great film, Mondo Topless, which kind of encapsulates part of my aesthetic. But there's so many, Betty Page, Mark Twain, Ray Dennis Steckler, kind of people who are off the beaten path culturally, and maybe they stick their finger in the eye of conformity, and that's really what I try to get across.
What do you think about music lends well to sort of discussing and presenting these kinds of topics?
Well, I try to use music that is easy to listen to, that you could listen to the music without understanding the words, and you might, you know, find it amusing or entertaining. But the words are a little more difficult to deal with, because you get past just the melody and the chords, and you get into dark issues of insincerity, but all of the things that make people behave badly and then try to hide it. And it happens all the time. Everybody is that way. Infidelity, lust, greed. You name the seven deadly sins, and that's mostly what I write about.
Are you writing about these themes from like a personal perspective, or is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm human, so all of these things are things that resonate with me, but they resonate with everybody, and they're universal themes, and they always have been. You go back to Chaucer and his Canterbury Tales, and he was talking about the same kind of things that I write about in my songs today, which is the, you know, carnal, the lust, the greed, the shamefulness that, you know, people give into because it's their nature, and then they try to hide it. And then there's the people who, you know, put them down for that and pretend to be better than them until, of course, they're found out, you know. Happens all the time. Look at all the preachers who are discovered, you know, with prostitutes, or, you know, stealing money from their congregations, or, you know, things like that. So this is the material that I like to deal with.
Do you think people are better or worse in present day at accepting this kind of material?
In certain areas they are. I mean, Rochester is kind of an open-minded place. As conservative as it is in some respects, you look around at how Pride Week is celebrated here, and you can see that Rochester has a very strong accepting community. And I find that there are people who come to the Spirit Room and hear me specifically because of the kind of subject material I deal with. And then there will always be those who, you know, are against that. And, you know, there are places in this country right now that are very much at war with progressivism and against anything that might be considered naughty or lewd. But, I mean, that's what I celebrate. And the people I find like it get it. Some people don't, and, you know, that's okay.
Have you ever personally encountered, like, backlash or, you know, mothers covering their children's ears, so to speak?
Well, no, you don't find mothers with their kids down in the Spirit Room too much. So, no, I have not encountered that. But I think it's easy. People will not come up to you and tell you they don't like it. They're not going to get into your face about that. What they'll do is they'll just stop showing up. You know, they'll just say, you know, I don't want to hear this naughty music from this bad musician person, you know. So they weed themselves out, and then what's left behind are the interesting people.
So what's your process for putting these sort of experiences and observations into song?
Well, it just comes to me, and I'll be driving down the road, and something will just hit me, and I don't know where it comes from, but maybe it's just a word. Sometimes it's just a word. For example, I got an email from someone, and they used the word bamboo. They said they were bamboozled. I thought, bamboozled, what a great word that is. And so I wrote a song called Bamboozling Baby. And it's about, you know, a man singing about his girlfriend who's bamboozling him, you know, cheating him out of his money and, you know, kind of stringing him on and that kind of thing. So stuff just comes to me, and, you know, if it's the right thing, then it becomes a song. And I don't find any trouble putting the words down on the paper. They just kind of come. Maybe I'm just tapped into the most evil parts of the human heart, that it just, you know, flows.
Were you always so comfortable with this kind of subject material, or was it something that you kind of grew into?
Oh, no, always been totally comfortable with it. And that goes back to my early days of being influenced by people like Robert Crumb, who just wrote about things that were totally socially unacceptable, but he had his finger on the pulse of something. John Waters, the same thing. I mean, when Pink Flamingos came out, that was a huge, huge deal and very, very controversial. Now, a lot of the, I mean, now you see John Waters' stuff performed on Broadway. You know, he's celebrated by middle-class people, so that's how things can change. But down, when you get below the surface and start digging into the deep stuff, there's always room for discomfort there, and that's kind of the zone that I work in.
Why do you think it's important to face this kind of discomfort?
Because that's the only thing that's interesting. I mean, how many times can you listen to happy music and, you know, songs about I love you and, oh, you know, everything's great? No, whether you're talking about literature or art or whatever, music, it's always the things that are slightly uncomfortable that are the most interesting, in my view, and the things that last. I mean, look at Hieronymus Bosch, one of the great painters of the Middle Ages, and the things that he used to paint, these horrible, horrid scenes of people, you know, being burned in hell and, you know, eaten by eggs with legs. I mean, really trippy stuff. I mean, that stuff lives on, and it continues to be absolutely beautiful. But, you know, you look at the, you know, 19th century romantics and, you know, pictures of fruit and baskets and stuff like that. I mean, you know, who cares about that?
For sure. I think that humans have this, like, innate fascination with, like, the taboo, or, you know, the harder they try and repress those kinds of thoughts and feelings, the harder they kind of fight back.
Absolutely. Repression is like the fertilizer in the soil of, you know, sin. You know, you repress and it just makes the roots stronger and the shoots come up faster. And if you don't repress and you express it, then you can deal with it. But, you know, we've always had a repressive society, and in some ways we seem to be heading back in that direction, at least in certain parts of the country. I don't know if it's true everywhere, but that has to be fought. And that's part of the Spirit Room's mission, I think, is to have a place where things can be expressed that you can't necessarily be expressed everywhere.
So specifically, let's get into some of your music. Back Home Saturday Night is, mm-hmm. I always keep going back to the song because of the story that it tells of just an absolutely chaotic family evening.
Well, Papa's in the alley, Mama's full of gin, Sister's in the bedroom doing Uncle Jim. Well, all right. Well, all right. Well, all right, cause I'm back home Saturday night. Well, Mama's in the basement trying something new. Alcohol, fentanyl, oxycontin too. Well, all right. Well, all right. Well, all right, cause I'm back home Saturday night. Well, Daddy's getting angry, looking for his gun. Loaded up at 45, he's gonna have some fun. Well, all right. All right. Well, all right, cause I'm back home Saturday night.
And I think part of the important part of that is to recognize that this takes place in the countryside, like in Appalachia. You know, rural America has been decimated by corporate agriculture and outsourcing and things like that, and then the opioid crisis and meth and all of this. And our, you know, the traditional view of the countryside is this pristine kind of place with red barns and, you know, cows and everything. That existed one time. I remember, because if you grow up in upstate New York, you're never, you know, too far from the country. And I went to a high school that was half kids from farms and the other half were the local, like, suburban kids. And I spent summers on farms. I know what it's like. I know what it was like back in the day. But you drive through the country today and you go into some of these back roads and you just see poverty and desolation. And a lot of it is related to the breakdown of their society. And so that song is kind of what that's all about. The country is not the countryside is not a safe space. Appalachia is not a safe space. It's a dangerous space. And, you know, nowadays it's all about drugs and AR-15s and you know, if you want a clue into this, there's a great movie called The Wild Wonderful Whites of West Virginia. It's a documentary about this one family in West Virginia, and you know, you watch that and you get a sense of what I'm talking about.
So moving to maybe a more urban environment, working on the Vice Squad kind of tells the story of like a police officer sort of going through and wrangling up, you know, the kids doing drugs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's, it struck me that the whole idea of having a Vice Squad is so ridiculous. And what must that job be like? You know, you can imagine some really earnest police officer taking his job seriously and going around and, you know, making sure that the strip joints are keeping the pasties on and that, you know, women are not out on the street. Everybody knows it's going to happen every day of every year as long as there have been human beings. And at some point, you know, is this person going to wake up and realize that his job is just like a joke? And, you know, what's the point of it? I can't imagine what working on the Vice Squad must be like day in and day out, but it's got to be like just a ridiculous job. So that's what that's all about. Vice is part of human nature. It's not going away. It's always going to be here. And, you know, you try to control it and you just end up looking like a fool.
I think nowadays things have moved over from, you know, punishment and repression, or I'd like to think so, from punishment and repression to sort of like education and understanding about what vices are and how you can explore them in like a safe way. I don't know if you'd agree.
Maybe
with
in
that.
some spots, but you look at the country, the direction the country's going in right now, it's like the 1950s all over again. It's repression is coming back in with a vengeance. Morality is coming back in with a vengeance. And, you know, it's, I don't see how this ends well. Fortunately, I think Rochester is a good place, relatively speaking. The people here are nice. They're reasonable people. They're accepting people. And I have a lot of hope for Rochester, but I don't have a lot of hope for a lot of parts of this country.
Obviously, I think that your music and having the opportunity to perform is certainly helping that image and helping the community.
Oh, yeah, I'm providing a great social service. I really ought to be paid for it. Now, you know, and that's, okay, all the kudos go to Rachel and Jake down at the Spirit Room with the space that they've created where it's not just me. I mean, they have all kinds of performers doing all kinds of things, and a lot of it would be raise a few eyebrows in, you know, some of the more conservative circles, but they're fulfilling a very important role in providing that space.
If you could send out a message or give some advice to someone who's sort of wrestling with their inner demons, what would you say?
Well, the first thing I would say is never take my advice. I'm like the worst advice. If I was any good at giving advice, I would have taken my own and, you know, made something of myself. But no, I mean, basically just be honest with yourself and, you know, you get into some touchy areas here because you could be dealing with some serious mental health issues, which I'm totally unqualified to deal with. But then sometimes you're just talking about the general need to express oneself and feel accepted in doing that. And for those people, there are spaces, there are places for you where you can do that. And whether it's the Out Alliance or the Spirit Room or any number of places around that are offer, you know, an opportunity to be yourself.
That's sort of all I have. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to touch on or you wanted to bring up.
I just like to send a message out to anyone who's listening. Take some time and listen to some of the old stuff that you wouldn't come across. I find that these days a lot of even, you know, good musicians who are kind of well aware of a lot of music are not aware of certain things, you know. So, you know, take a look at Blind Blake. Take a listen to Blind Blake, Bessie Smith, Emmett Miller, Bob Wills and his, you know, Texas Playboys. You know, this is seminal roots stuff that is really important, especially Jelly Roll Morton. Jelly Roll Morton, in his final years, tried to make a comeback, and he made these recordings for a label called General. You know, appreciate the past. It's partly about honoring the past, honoring the dead, honoring the sacrifices and the contributions that they made, and go ahead and turn on the radio and listen to what's going on.